Nathan and Joy Clarkson, Enneagram Sevens, both of you, brother and sister. Joy, scholar, author, host of Speaking with Joy, the podcast and storyteller. Nathan, award-winning actor, best-selling author of the memoir Different and the memoir Good Man, and the upcoming book by the two of you, The Clubhouse. Wow, that was a mouthful, Anthony.
We were just talking before we got on here. This is our first set of siblings.
It is. And did you hear their CV? It's like so long. We just have to close the show now. It's like we took all of our time describing their credits.
And post, we'll be rolling the music right now. See you later, folks.
That's great.
Boy, we had a great time with Nathan and Joy, didn't we? They were really something. I loved it. Again, like Anthony said, first time siblings on the show. Not often do you get siblings of the same type, the enthusiast, on the same show, and I want to dive into that. What the heck was your house like growing up with two sevens banging around, probably like pinballs?
That's a good question, and funnily enough, there's a little story that goes with why we might be sevens. I was about, I don't know, 6 years old, I think. No, I was five. I was 5 years old, and I told my mom I really wanted a little sister, and she was 42 at the time, says, oh, honey, no, that's not going to happen. And at the same time, she was trying to teach me, because she was a good Christian mother, the power of prayer. And so I said, well, I'm going to start praying for a little sister. And, you know, she didn't want to ruin my understanding of God and prayer and these things, but she didn't know how to let me down and tell this isn't going to happen. So I started praying every day, and lo and behold, a few weeks later, she was pregnant with Joy. So I think God endowed Joy with my personality, so I could have someone to hang out with who got me. But Joy and I are the class clowns and the fun, I hate to say that, but we're the fun people of the family, but we're also the youngest boy and youngest girl. So honestly, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, and I feel like with a name like Joy, I was bound to be a seven, right? Like, what would I do? if I wasn't a seven? What have I done if I was just a really depressive type? No, I think Nathan and I were the extroverts of the crowd, and it's fun because we express our sevenness and our enthusiasticness in very different ways. But we definitely brought a lot of energy and a lot of verbal. Our family was fairly verbal and intense anyway. We bring a lot of kind of Scotch-Irish wit, enthusiasm, and temper. And so you might think that Nathan and I brought the intensity, and I would say we brought the energy, but the intensity was already there.
What's the landscape of the family? Do you know what the other numbers might be?
So my dad would be a five, right, Nathan?
Yeah, I think so. That makes sense.
I was actually, I'm not exactly sure what my mom is. We were talking about this yesterday.
I think she could be a four, a one, an eight. Yeah,
I would say, I don't think an eight. I think she's a four or a one. Because there's a strong ideals center. Yeah, I think she might be a one. And then my sister is definitely a four. And then our other brother is, I think, a two. Right?
Okay. Yeah, so we're kind of all over.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right, so you're covering the spectrum of types almost, you know?
Mm-hmm. We're trying, yeah.
Let's get the Duggars on the show. Can we do that? Because we got to get every single type out of that group, right?
I'd love to come back for that one if I can. That'd right? be fun
and,
to watch.
And we'd get some hillbilly humor out of that, no doubt, right?
Right, yeah.
Love to probe into the Duggar psyches. That would be something to behold. Multi episodes for that one.
Right.
Maybe a whole season. All right, now you guys grew up, you loved using the Myers-Briggs. Did you do that as a family? Was that like something the family was into?
Yeah.
So my dad was a certified tester. Like you have to you know, when you do like the actual training with the MBTI Institute. So he did that, and he would do like workshops. We would have nights where everybody come over and talk about it. And yeah, so it was a big deal.
And it was also something I think that was a big part of our family dynamic, because we did have four kids. And I know that's not tons and tons, but I'd say nowadays four kids is a lot. And I think it really gave us this grit and understanding for understanding the unique and sides and differences between all of us. And that was something we grew up with. So it wasn't so much, we learned how to understand that each other had differences and those were good and worthy of being celebrated. So I think it really helped us both self-learn and others learn as we grew up, having these kind of grids of personality understanding. So that was something, I really loved it.
And I think also, you know, as our parents were trying to help us get along, there was a lot of, which I really appreciate, there was a strong impulse for self-awareness and a desire to be like, sometimes when your siblings do things that you don't enjoy, It's not because they're specifically trying to hurt you or annoy you. It's
or
because
that they're bad.
Or they're bad. It's just because people are different and we all relate differently, which is, I think, really helpful because that can, you know, keep certain personality types just from feeling like they are bad to exist. Mm. But yeah, I mean, I think our family just, we're kind of odd when you think about it this way, but like around the dinner table, there's kind of three things you'll talk about. Art, film, books, words. We do a lot of like vocabulary and I don't know how you can discuss words. We do that. And then talking about personalities and kind of trying to think about what makes us tick, why we love what we love. And
cool.
Well, that was helpful for me because I grew up with a lot of learning disabilities and mental illness. I got diagnosed very early. So having that understanding of celebrating differences rather than being ostracized or shamed because you fall outside of this familial or even cultural norm was really important for me as a young kid to kind of grasp this idea of we're made uniquely. Mm. And so that was something that was really beneficial to a young kid who had learning disabilities and mental illness. So I love the idea of these things, these tests that can help us understand and even more than that, celebrate ourselves.
Mm. All right. So let's just pop in on that for a second. You in your material, you talk about being neurodivergent. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know how an Enneagram 7 navigates a world in which they feel so different. And I'm making a guess here that you probably experienced some measure of social suffering as a result. Yeah. Is that fair?
Oh yeah, I can. It's not an isolated incident that multiple teachers have yelled at me in front of entire classes of people, and I was sitting there not knowing why this was happening. So this was something that happened pretty regularly.
Mm. Okay, so talk to us a little bit about what neurodivergent means. And how did you navigate as a 7 early on suffering?
That's a great question. And I don't know if I've ever had that one posed on a podcast before. How did I navigate suffering? As neurodivergent is people who diverge from the typical, the norm, the kind of understood and expected way of thinking and viewing the world. And that, you know, there's all sorts of different labels that can take in different ways it can go. For me, I was diagnosed with OCD very early on, ADHD, ODD, a lot of things. And later on was diagnosed with depression and dyslexia. I could go on. The list is really, really long and the things I was diagnosed with. But the way that looked practically in the life of a young kid, especially one who loved people, loved connection, love expressing himself, love all these things, is it made me, I experienced the grief in feeling alone and separated. And I'd say that one of the things I look back and that affected me most was feeling inherently bad and feeling inherently wrong. And this was not for my family. Thank goodness I had a family who celebrated me and loved me. But in any situation outside of the context of my family, I felt I began to notice at a young age, oh, I'm different. And I don't know. I can't do these. I can't read like this person. I can't understand this problem like this person in school. I don't know how to stop talking when everyone else seems to be able to. I don't know how to stop fighting or questioning or asking questions. And that seems to bring me a lot of trouble. And so I found myself as a kid feeling wrong, like the central part of who I was wrong. And I guess as I'm trying to think about how I processed pain, I think a lot of times I didn't, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It was something that I just chose not to. And obviously that has negative repercussions later on in life. But I learned to a little bit live with my dukes up and learned how to take one on the jaw. And I would say that processing pain was not and is not my strength. So, yeah, that's kind of what it looks like.
Yeah.
I wonder, as a sibling watching you, you were exceptionally creative. And sometimes I feel like that was I don't know if that was an outlet, but it.
Yeah, I don't think I knew I was processing pain in the context of creativity, but you're right. I did find solace and joy in my creative pursuits, especially ones that revolved around narrative, around story. And when I look at stories, when I look at the, you know, I was, as a kid, I loved Superman. I loved Batman. I loved the heroes. And those were the places, I guess, that, yeah, Joy, you're right. That's a good insight that I found comfort inside these stories because they gave me an arc to look at and one where I could place myself and have a future that envisioned hope for me if I could identify with these characters that went through their own battles. Mm. That's a really good insight.
That's good because sevens are future oriented, right?
Yes. In terms of
time. Yeah.
Absolutely. Three sevens and eights are their orientation to time is the future. Fours, fives, and nines, their orientation to time is the past. Ones, twos, and sixes, their orientation to time is the present. And when you know that, by the way, it provides you with a lot of insight into why oftentimes people don't get along. Mm-hmm. Mm. If you're married and you are married to a person with different time orientation, once you know that, it really explains some of the rub that can happen in the relationship, right? Because your particular orientation to time, you will unconsciously assume is the right one. It's the normal one. Mm-hmm. And so that means it gives you leash to judge someone whose orientation to time is different. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, doesn't end well. Ends in tears for everybody, as they say. You know, it's interesting. You're both storytellers and interested in story. You know that the communication style for sevens is storytelling, right?
Mm-hmm. I do now.
So every type has a communication style. So for ones, it would be, you know, teaching when not careful, it devolves into preaching. Twos, you know, or, you know, how else do I say it? Like threes would be promotion and marketing. Fours would be lament. Fives, symposium is what we say. Wow. You know, sixes, catastrophizing. Sevens, storytelling. Eights, barking. Authority is a word we use sometimes. And nines, it's called epic saga. It's no surprise to me that both of you are storytellers because that's sort of your natural zone as a seven. And going back to you, Nathan, I think that there would be similarities to every type, I guess, as to how they navigate or integrate suffering early in life, right? But the seven typically would retreat into the headspace, right? And they would very much retreat in. They would create something of a Neverland. And so sixes kind of cope with the world, their anxiety. And you have OCD, which is sort of an anxiety-based disorder. And, you know, I think that with all that anxiety, sevens tend to cope with anxiety by creating a world of unlimited possibilities and fun and story, and everything seems to be shimmering to the seven, right? With possibility.
Yeah, possibility everywhere.
Yes, everywhere, right?
And that's where the hope lays too, right? In the possibility.
Yes. And so a six copes in many ways with anxiety through pessimism. And the seven with optimism. Does that ring true in your experience?
Yeah, it does. I think, you know, when I mentioned earlier that in processing my pain, it wasn't something I wanted to do. I'd rather find a way to move forward, to look forward, to hope for tomorrow. And it's interesting hearing about the communication types, because that resonates with me so strongly, that I communicate, I even think, my whole interior world, my mind, is in the context of narrative and story. Everything I see is a part of the story. And interestingly enough, my OCD triggers revolve around things that don't fit the narrative of my story, how they should. Ooh. You know, if you imagine yourself in a movie, I'm going, this thing doesn't fit in this scene. This person doesn't belong here. That shouldn't have been said. And so my triggers always revolved around things that didn't fit the narrative of the life and the story I wanted to live. So that's really interesting. Mm.
So Joy, as you think about your life as a seven, and by the way, I'm also curious, are you like maybe an ENTP?
Yeah, well done.
Yeah. What about you, Joy?
I tend to come out as an EN and then stronger FJ but I can kind of sometimes vacillate on the T and the F and the P and the J.
Yeah, I would imagine vacillating on the T and the F would be true if you're a a seven. F's, I don't want to stereotype, but often fall into that heart triad, you know? But I would say a lot of times with sevens, they sort of fall in that ENTP space. And there's some literature out there correlating Enneagram types with Myers-Briggs types. And which is kind of fascinating, all speculative, but interesting to read about, you know? And, now both of you mentioned early before we started recording about the importance of self-knowledge and self-awareness and learning about who we are and why we are and wrestling with large existential questions. Joy, talk to me about that in your life.
Well, I think I'll talk to you about it in my life right now. Okay. I'll zoom in on the, though I am a future-oriented person, right now I'm in this space where I just submitted a PhD and am looking at what are the choices I'm making. And when I think about that, for me, what feels really important is knowing why you make the decisions you make. And a lot of that boils down to what you want, what you're afraid of, and being able to kind of pinpoint those things and not try to control them, but just kind of be aware of what's orienting me in the world and what makes me move towards certain things when I'm in a place of stress or of disintegration. That I think is, that's for me has been one of the most important things about self-reflection, whether it's with Enneagram or just kind of prayer and being thoughtful or with Myers-Briggs is thinking about what motivates me in the world. So like, when I'm in a happy, good place, I am, I love to dig in deep. You know, I think they, correct me if I'm wrong, but sevens in a good place become kind of scholarly and excited and deep and
like fives, right? You go to the high side like five. Of five.
And so I like to think that I'm incredibly healthy because I've gone into academics. You know, clearly that means that I've just, you know, really maxed out. What's funny is that when I first encountered the Enneagram, this is kind of me getting off on a trail. When I first encountered the Enneagram, it was actually in grad school, and it was a whole bunch of my friends were really into it. And they were like, oh, you're for sure a one, which I don't think you're supposed to tell people what number they are.
No.
So that was definitely not. And I remember reading it thinking, I'm not this. But as I started to kind of read through the Enneagram and think about what number I was, and I read the seven and I thought that's what I am, I thought, oh, well, of course they thought I was a one. I was in a super stressed, not healthy place in my life.
Right.
And I think, so I think having the awareness of what motivates me, what do I love, what do I fear, but also what does it look like when I'm not healthy? Having those tools for kind of evaluating a scale of growth is really helpful so that you're making good choices and that you're moving forward and that you're not kind of being ruled by disintegrated fears and unadmitted desires.
That's really great. Are you drawn to the mystics?
Oh, for sure.
That's a very seven quality.
Yeah.
Really seven quality. Lots of, there's a particular type of seven that is really drawn to the mystics and to mystical experience and even, I don't know if I would say the contemplative life, though some are, you know, but there are a lot of sort of seven mystics. St. Francis would be a perfect example of a seven mystic, you know?
St. Francis was a seven.
Yes.
This makes a lot of sense.
Oh, yeah. I mean, total seven behavior all over the place, you know. I wrote a book about Francis, so he's one of my favorite all-time historical figures.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Also, that's interesting.
It makes me think of with the connection with mystics, because I think people often think of mystics as like very, you know, demure and serious, and you know, and not that sevens can't be serious, and but there's this kind of pull toward future, towards optimism, towards hope. And it makes me think of, so when you said, are you into the mystics? I wanted to be like, well, which one? Because there are many that I love.
But be specific.
But I would say, but one of them is, I think it was Teresa of Avila that said, God save me from the gloomy saints. And that there was this sense of, like, I love it in Teresa, but in Julie, and also of this, like, need to to reckon with the darkness of the world, because we have that kind of fear of pain and everything, but then to find the beauty or the joy or the gold at the heart mm-hmm. of existence.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I don't know, that seems to me to be something I'm very drawn to. Yeah.
Looking for the pony, as we might say in common parlance, right? Looking for the pony. So how, in your experience, if I had your parents on here, right? And I said to them, how do you raise sevens? Mm. What would they say?
That's a good question. You know, I did write a book about what it's like to grow up as a seven, and from my mom's perspective, what it's like to raise a seven. But in going off the themes that we explored there, I think one thing that was always difficult for me, it still really is, you know, I chose a life of an actor and a writer and a filmmaker where I get to choose everything I do, and no one's telling me what to do ever, which is, I think, something that has a lot to do with has everything to do with my personality. But I'd say knowing that about myself and about this type is, it's, how do I say it? I don't want to be cliche, but it's giving them room to be themselves. Mm-hmm. It's giving them room to explore who they want to be. It's giving them room to live outside of the box and be celebrated for that, rather than imposing preconceived grids and notions and boundaries. I'm not talking about training, I'm not talking about discipline. Those are important things. I'm talking about expectations of personality or what life should look like, how they should act. Let them live into and explore their own personhood, even if it doesn't look like what culture, church, family expects or thinks it should.
Mm.
And I think this is kind of on the opposite end of that. I feel like one of the problems with sevens, and I see this in both Nathan's and my own life, is that we are Renaissance people. We can like kind of do most of what you'd throw at us. And that can lead to just like having, you always have so many options. And so I think one of the things that's helpful, or that would be helpful with parents, is teach your sevens how, when to say yes and how to say no, you know, like how to evaluate what is the possibility worth saying yes to. Because my impulse is always just to like do everything. And yeah. I can imagine, I remember when I was in high school, I really wanted a job. And I was like, even this really boring job could be so fun. Imagine, it would be great. You'd meet people, you'd make money. And I just kind of have the capacity to imagine the good in almost anything. And that's a great, wonderful, exciting thing and makes me good at a lot of things. But it can also mean that you can say yes to way too much.
I remember my therapist, Joy, he once said that intuitives make terrible investors because they see the good in everything, even in places they shouldn't. They see the possibility in everything. Mm-hmm. So on the flip side of what I said, I completely agree. I think that let them explore, but also help them focus their energy into things that have the most possibility for good.
Yeah.
You know, I have a friend of mine who has a seven son who developed a gambling problem. And she said that one time he said to her, in a time of crisis, he said, I never saw a hand I didn't think was a winner.
Interesting.
And that's that kind of, I call that, that's toxic positivity. Mm-hmm. And sevens have to be careful of that. That sometimes positivity can have a toxic quality to it, yeah. right? A self-destructive quality to it that they have to, you know, be vigilant about and to make sure that they don't fall prey to their own kind of delusional optimism about life,
yeah.
you know? I also have a seven son, and I'll brag on him for a little bit. He goes to Brown University, just is graduating now, and it worked out in some ways to be a great place for him because there are no course requirements. So it's just one big buffet. Like you don't have to like you just go and you're like, I remember his first semester at school, Anthony, I said, well, what's your favorite course right now? He goes, Atlantic Pirates. And I said, you're taking a course on Atlantic pirates. And he started going into, yeah, you know, I'm learning about the knots and the boats and what pirates did and, you know, on and on and on, but at a deep academic level, right? So currents and things like that and why pirates did this. And I said, $70,000 Atlantic pirates. I'm paying yeah. for it. But for a seven.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah. Well, but for a seven, it was heaven.
Yeah.
And it was okay. also hell. Yeah. And it was also
oh, interesting
because interesting. Where he has learned now, and my kids all know the Enneagram. He's 24 now. And what they've learned and what he's now learning through experience is how much he needs structure.
Yeah.
Like he has to have structure. If he doesn't, that freewheeling mind runs all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. and he never finds the he overruns the banks of his own river, you know,
yeah.
and it's just, you know, and so he's learning that now as he's, you know, I mean, that's the gift of the Enneagram, the gift of self-awareness is like, it's just going to save you time. He's not going to learn that now at 30. He can know it now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
yeah, I learned at 30. Yeah. I learned rhythm and the importance of structure at 30 and I'm still learning it, but yeah, absolutely.
And of course, being in a PhD program, and of course, as a scholar, you have to hunker down and get focused, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I don't, I know it's different in the US, but the UK PhD programs are very, you do have to hunker down, but they're very unstructured. You know,
yes.
they kind of just say, you send in a proposal, they say, good, you meet with an advisor and they set you loose. And I really struggled the first year because I would just end up reading. I read a whole bunch of books that I loved, but I would just get really into books that I didn't actually need to read for my PhD. And I'd be like, great, I've read everything that Alistair McIntyre wrote. That doesn't really have anything to do with my PhD. And the thing that really helped me was that in my second year, I was living in Oxford and there was this thing called the scriptorium where you would go in the morning, they'd have morning prayer. Everybody had to sit around and say what you wanted to get done that day. You'd work for an hour and a half, they give you coffee. You work for an hour and a half, they give you lunch. Work for an hour and a half, coffee. And just having that 3 days a week where I would go and have structured time. I wrote like 60% of my thesis just because I had that structure. And it had to be a structure that was outside of me that I wasn't just internally generating.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you know what's helped me is I've realized I don't do well with schedules, right? I don't do well with, you know, at 10:30 you're doing this, at, you know, schedules always make me feel constrained and tied in, and the day has no mystery or excitement in it, or life or week or whatever it is. But what it has helped me a lot, and you know, again, this is a learning journey, I'm still learning it, but it's, I don't need a schedule, but I do need a checklist. And what that look, because I'm an actor and author and a podcaster, and I have my own schedule. I make it, and if I'm not careful, like Joy was saying, you have all this free time that you are the master of your own fate, and a lot of times you'll, okay, well, I played 6 hours of video games, didn't get a lot done today, even though I have all these big dreams. But so the checklist has always really helped me. It's like, if I can start my day knowing at the end of it, I want to have all this done, then I can play 6 hours of video games, even as long as I get everything I need done in that one last hour. But that gives me the freedom to live in my personality the way I do, and it was made to, but also it pulls me along and it pulls me forward and gives me the practical steps that every day I'm making progress in my life. So checklist versus schedule has really helped. That concept has really helped me a lot.
Yes. You know, the passion, of course, of the seven is gluttony, and meaning that they cannot possibly cram enough fun, excitement, adventures, escapades, ideas, fascinating conversations, books, everything. They just can't get enough. And so they're cursed with the more, 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 you
Amen.
Know, dilemma. And their antidotal virtue, one of, I think, several virtues that they have to really cultivate is sobriety. And sobriety meaning really focused attention on a singular goal, right? Like it's like for you to do a PhD, right? It's a wonderful thing for a seven to be able to work their way through, you know, undergrad, master's level work, then PhD work. It's like that requires a lot of singular focus and topically a lot of singular focus. And that's a very healthy thing for a seven to stay the course. Don't get dragged off point. finish what you start. I bet you there's a lot of, sevens who did all their coursework for their PhD and never got to the thesis because something more interesting came along that got their attention, and off they went, you know, chasing that, mm-hmm. you know. So singular focus, long leashes, give them long leashes, but keep them on a leash, mm-hmm. right? They need a leash,
yeah.
but give them a lot of lead. Right, to investigate.
See where to put it, yeah, you know, absolutely.
If you put too short a lead on a seven, you'll run into a lot of resistance mm-hmm. and a lot of pullback, because sevens hate people who shut down their options, and they don't like limitations imposed on them.
Yeah.
Oh, Joy, you're making a face.
No, I was just having a self-awareness moment.
They do not like people who try to place limitations on them at all.
And well, you know, I was diagnosed with ODD, which is, I don't know if you know this, but it's mm-hmm. oppositional yes. defiance disorder mm-hmm. as a kid.
Yes.
And, you know, I highly believe in diagnosis and mental illness and all this, but I always question that one. I'm like, do I have ODD or am
you
I just...
It.
Is that just my personality? Yeah. Well, and that's a whole other thing about these personality talks and the diagnosis is part of my personality goes, I'm not a seven. You can't tell me I'm a seven, because a seven boxes me in. It tells me what I am. Like, no, I could be any of them at any time. I can switch to a three if I want to. And so it's interesting thinking about that's a very seven reaction to being told you're a seven.
Yes.
And it's just like reflexive, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's,
yeah.
Yeah.
How dare you? You don't know that.
Yes.
I'm not. Well,
and I feel like you have a little bit of eight in you too, Nathan, which has a little bit of
that's my wing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do those usually go together, seven and eight?
No, the seven with six is, you know, very common. Seven with eight. Those are both the wings of the seven. Joy would not be as pugnacious as you are. She would
heard that
be,
word before.
She would be more, not as quick to, let me put it this way. If the two of you were jumping off a cliff, a 30-foot cliff into the water, Nathan, you would be the first one off without asking how deep it is.
Yes, absolutely. Right?
Joy
I've
would
literally done that.
Yes, and Joy would probably ask how deep it was first, and then she would be one of the first to go. But she has a little bit of the anxiety of the six to asking her the question in her mind, well, what could go wrong?
Yeah.
You don't stop.
That's great. That's very accurate. And I was actually thinking when you were talking about how you cope with anxiety, I do storytelling, but in a different way than Nathan does, which is I think, what is the worst thing that could happen? And then I tell myself how I would make it out of that story. Okay. You know, and I reconcile myself to it and move through it, which is still a form of storytelling. You know, it's still a way of, it's still future oriented. It's still getting through it, but it's a more anxious way of dealing with it? Or it's just, I think a more,
yeah, I mean, I just think that a seven with a six would be more likely to tap the brakes before a seven with an eight would. Just tap the brakes a little bit. The eight just, you know, foot to the floor.
Brakes aren't fun.
Brakes are not fun. No, you
not
just
fun.
Keep your foot on the gas. Who needs a break? You know. So Anthony and I were laughing because here we are. We're talking to two sevens. You have a book. When does the book drop, or has it dropped?
It has.
It has.
It is out right now.
A fun fact is that the release date was shifted around because, do you remember a few months ago when there was that ship that was stuck in
Suez Canal?
In the Suez Canal, that was it, the Evergreen or something?
Yes.
Okay. It got delayed because it was, I'm sure it wasn't on the Evergreen, but it was like in the thing. So we we think that's kind of fun.
You are the second author today on the podcast who has recently had a book come out and talked about we may have a delay in the actual drop of the book because of paper shortages.
I've heard about this.
So there's paper problems, there's ink delays, there's all, I mean, you know, gosh, we just bought a house and like back in February and I still don't have furniture. So anyway, that's how it's going out there in the world, you know. So, all right, but it is not lost on us that two Enneagram Sevens have written a book called The Clubhouse, Open the Door to Limitless Adventure.
Limitless.
Limitless adventure.
You couldn't have made this more, like, cartoonishly accurate.
No. This is a caricature. I've never, you know, it's like, you know, and, you know, Your name is Joy. You've written a book about Open the Door to Limitless Adventure, The Clubhouse.
Which let's is, get lost in our imagination.
Let's get lost in our imaginations, creativity and play. I mean, really, by the way, I'm encouraging everyone to buy this this book, and here's why.
Yeah.
Nobody writes with more authority on the topic than two Enneagram
right.
sevens.
That's right. Yeah.
And this is biographical. This isn't just made up. This was literally written about me and my siblings. I was 10 years old and Joy helped me write this. And this is literally written about it. We would go out. Joy and I would go outside. We had this little clubhouse there in Colorado on top of the hill. And every day it would literally be limitless what this clubhouse could be. It was a castle. It was a spaceship. It was a wagon. It was a million different things, because Joy and I liked working out our imagination in these ways. And also in doing that as kids, it really did prepare us for the lives we led as adults. And we think this is valuable for any number, very any person, cool. but this was something that we as sevens, I think, really naturally did and did together.
Wonderful. Tell us the arc. I mean, this is a children's book. Yes. Yeah. And which means that it's also for adults.
That's right.
And, absolutely. As all children's books are. Mm-hmm. Arc of the narrative. What is this story that gets told?
Well, the story is really, it's very simple. It is a girl and a boy. So the opening line, Nathan, what's the opening line?
Through wooden nails, a boy and girl play. What will the clubhouse be today?
And then throughout the whole story, the simple narrative is just a girl and a boy having these different adventures in a clubhouse through the power of their imagination. And the way it came about was actually Nathan wrote kind of the bones of this poem, because it goes through, you know, perhaps it'll be a wagon that you're riding through the wilderness, or maybe it'll be a submarine beneath the ocean depths. And he wrote kind of the bones of this when he was 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. And my dad found it on like a floppy disk. Didn't know this still existed. But
that's how old I am.
Yeah. And so he sent it to Nathan, and then Nathan and I were like, oh, this would be so much fun. And I think part of it was we just so cherished those kind of blessedly boring, open-ended, playful afternoons. Mm. And, you know, this is not against screens or anything, but, you know, we feel like everything is so full. There's so much stimulation that we wanted to capture the joy of just open-ended play and imagination and delight. And so we did that through the story. So it's just a girl and boy. And on one page, it's a submarine. On one page, it's a castle. On one page, it's a stage. And the illustrator.
Yeah, it just goes on and on.
It goes on and on. So it's all the different things it could become. And the illustrator is just Joshua Timothy Taylor. It's just amazing. It's like a very whimsical Where's Waldo. So there's like tons and tons and tons of details on every page. And there's things you can find.
Fun.
And and our goal was really just to capture the joy of imagination and play, and how our creative capacities, our forward-thinking imaginative capacities can transform any space into anything through storytelling. And then to inspire parents and kids to go do that, because we think it's so important for many reasons, you know, for the pure fun of it, but also for cognitive development, for moral development, you know, being able to tell yourself a story and imagine yourself in stories is a part of how you figure out what it means to be good or brave or strong. And so anyway, that's kind of why we wrote the book, and that's the general arc.
That's wonderful.
Love that,
isn't it? I mean that. I'm a fan of this book. I know I wrote it, I sound biased, but I literally, because I'm still a child, because that's what sevens are, I will pour over the pages and spend an hour just looking at the details and finding, by the way, there's a hidden dog and a hidden cat on every single page, and I had a blast spending a lot of time trying to find it. It really is so detailed. So I'm a grown up who loves his children's book.
There's also a hidden bowl of macaroni on every page.
Nice.
Eugene Peterson said, imagination is the way to get inside the truth.
Oh, yes.
I love that.
That is true.
Yeah.
That is absolutely true. And you know, when we think about, I don't want to dive too deep into church stuff, but I think one of the greatest problems that the church has is it has no theology of imagination that's widely studied.
Amen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah. There is a theology. I mean, people do write about theology and imagination, Joy, as you well know, but the church doesn't think about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, doesn't talk about it. Doesn't, you know, we have a theology discussion about everything, but imagination and actually the paucity of imagination is what so damages. And I think,
I'm going to make a bold statement here that might be get me into trouble. I think that that's mostly a failure on the part of Protestants, because really the Catholics, the Catholic imagination, the sacramental imagination is such a rich topic in Catholic writing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Joy's going like this. I could tell she wants to say something.
I'll send you my PhD when it's printed.
I would love to read it.
Yeah.
I would love to read it because actually I've given a couple of lectures on the sacramental imagination, and just because I come from a Catholic background, and I did graduate work at Fordham, you know, where that was a big piece of the conversation. And
I walk by it every day.
You do?
Yeah, I live right in the one up by Lincoln Center. Yeah.
Oh yeah, right.
One of the campuses. Yeah.
Yeah, I was in the Bronx. Sorry, but hey, I took the train to the Bronx. But anyway, it was a great experience, and of course, you know, I always sort of get despair a little bit of Protestant circles sometimes because of their unfamiliarity with some of these topics. You know, not to say none of them are, but I'm just saying there's a good number that. Let me put it this way. Main Street Protestants, how's that, are unfamiliar with any conversation around deep discussions on what is imagination, how does it function, why is it important, et cetera.
Absolutely. Well,
and if I can just stick in a little, I'm slightly jet lagged, so the words not coming to my brain.
A little caveat.
I want to say something about it. We were talking about mystics earlier.
Yes.
And one of the mystics that I studied for my PhD, so the question of my PhD was, kind of how does art form the spiritual life, or how can it form particularly the affective life? And one of the figures I researched a lot was Bonaventure.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the books about Bonaventure came from Fordham. And Bonaventure had this real impulse in the 12th century to cultivate the emotional and imaginative life. There was a sense that to be a really spiritual person, you needed to feel it deeply in your bones, and you needed to really identify with Jesus. And he he was the head of the Franciscans, and one of his big kind of things was that he commissioned his priests to create images, poetry, music that helped people engage their emotions and their imagination with faith, and kind of move from this kind of more intellectual capacity towards imagination and connection and affection. And anyway, I like Bonaventure a lot, and I think you're right, and I think there are reasons theologically that imagination is maybe a little bit less important from a...
But I also think it's such an important...
But it doesn't have to be.
Right. It's an aspect of God, though. I mean, in the very opening of Scripture, you see this creator, this artist who is imagining something and bringing it into being. Imagining is an aspect of God that I think is one of the main aspects of us being created in his image when we act it out. And so it seems like it's a little kid's book about, oh yeah, imagine, because we hear it tossed away like that all the time, right? Oh, imagination's great. And you see it in kids' contexts. But I think to imagine is something that when we take part in, we are acting in the image of God.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, we could just go off on this subject. I could go off on this subject for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Forget the Enneagram. Let's just talk about theology and imagination and art. Let's just spend a lot of time in that space. All right. So I want to encourage everybody to go out and get this new wonderful book, The Clubhouse, Open the Door to Limitless Adventure, written by two Enneagram Sevens. Who better than Enneagram Sevens to write this book? No one, he says. No one, he says. Guys, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having us. It's been great.
This has been so fun.
Yeah.
This has been so fun. And Ian, I hope this is okay, but I feel like given our conversation, I need to tell you that I am also coming out with a book. And the only reason I'm saying this is that the title is probably the most, it might be even more seven than our title of our book.
Oh, I can't wait.
It's called Aggressively Happy.
Please tell me that's not true. You just made that up, didn't you?
I did not. You can go look at the Amazon page.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, maybe you do have an eight wing.
Aggressively Happy.
Aggressively.
Oh, my gosh. Well, on that note, ladies and gentlemen, you can't whenever people say to me, well, are you sure? And sometimes I have doubts about the Enneagram. You know what I mean? I spend a lot of time in it. But even still, you know, this little part of me is a little skeptical. And I'm always like, well, I don't know. I don't know. And then I have a conversation like this. And I'm like, you can't make it up. It's just so accurate. It's kind of accurate. You just can't make it up. All right. Well, there it is. Joy Clarkson, author of Aggressively Happy and The Clubhouse, Open the Door to Limitless Adventure. Nathan, the book Good Man and the book Different, both memoirs. We've loved having you on. Thank you so much. Again, people, The Clubhouse, Open the Door to Limitless Adventure. Run to your computer now. Go to Amazon. Buy the book. How's that, Anthony?
Yeah.
I mean, I just wanted to get it out there.
That's right.
Right?
That's good.
Thank you.
You bet. Everybody, remember these words. May you have love. May you have joy. May you have peace. May you have healing. And may you have rest. Oh, and may you have fun.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.